I've been asked to talk to you guys about money and wealth and things like that, business and so on. The institute that I run has economics as one of its concerns. I've been studying Catholic social doctrine for a very, very long time now. Of course, that's a kind of central concern of Catholic social doctrine as well. But what I thought I would do today is really kind of focus on some older resources in the tradition that raise questions about problems associated with wealth. We can talk in question and answer period about any things that you might want to discuss with regard to more, current concerns about wealth. But I thought I'd just at least begin by looking at some of these resources, because one of the things that often happens in conversations like this, and you probably have seen it if you followed at all, Pope Francis's interventions into economic issues, is that people become suspicious of the church's, concern for economics, for areas related to economics. You may recall, for instance, Steve Bannon saying, recently that the only reason the Catholic bishops care about immigration is because they want Hispanics, right, in their pews. They want their money. They want their, they want their presence in the pews. That, in other, suggesting, right, that the church is not concerned about these things from a good place, from sort of the core of theology, but instead has become concerned about them for its own financial issues, its own issues of personnel or, numbers and so on. But I want to show you that actually this has been stuff that the church has been thinking about for a very, very long time, and even give you a kind of glimpse into how it's been thinking about these things. So, first, Pope Gregory the Great. Anybody aware of Pope Gregory the Great? 6th century saint, right? Of course, was Pope in Rome. Among the many things that Pope Gregory the Great was responsible for as Pope were farms in Sicily. And I was going to sort of show you guys some letters of his, but I didn't get the copies of these guys in time. But in his letters, so Pope Gregory writing in 591, 592, he writes to subdeacons that he has who are in charge of these farms in Sicily. And his complaints are fantastic, right? So this one guy in particular, he really picks on this man named Subdeacon Peter. And he writes a series of letters to Subdeacon Peter, again in 591, 592. And these are in his collections of letters, if you want to look these up. I think they're like letters 42 and 50, among others, okay? And he complains at first, my brother, I hear things about the way you're running the farms in Sicily, the ones that you have under your control. And they're all written in like kind of wonderful ecclesiastical language where he's praising him, and it's all affection on the outside. Maybe it's an Italian thing too, right? It's all affection on the outside, but you can tell that he's really skewering this poor subdeacon. So certain of your lands lie fallow, right? And they should not be fallow. He complains about the fact that he's not selling the old cattle. So he's not sort of like rotating the stock of cattle and then earning income from that cattle to purchase new cattle. But one of my favorite complaints that he makes, and this is in the second letter, is he says two things. First, you've seized the... I hear from... what is the fellow's name? I can't remember the guy's name. Romanus. Romanus has come on behalf of a convent. You've seized their property, and you're now charging them rent, right? I want you to return their property to them, and then out of your own purse, repay the rent that you've charged them, right? So, very detailed complaint that he makes to him. And then the second one, this one's even better, is he says, you've sent me a miserable horse and 5 good asses. He says, I can't ride the miserable horse because it's miserable, right? And I can't ride the good asses because they're asses, right? So it's like, it's all just about his own ability to ride these things. You've sent me. So there's this kind of like back and forth between the Pope and Subdeacon Peter. The one kind of, clearly Subdeacon Peter has sent these as an insult to the Pope, right? He's angry at the Pope. But this shows already St. Gregory, right? The 6th century. Gregory the Great, this great Pope, has economic concerns, you know, first and foremost in these letters. Out of justice to the nuns, you have to return their property to them, right? And then compensate for them. You know, you have to send the right kinds of asses up to us. You have to charge the right kinds of taxes. He's concerned, for instance, about the taxes being charged to Jews on these properties, right? You know, you need to reduce the rate of taxes that you're charging to the Jews, in part to induce them to convert. Once they convert, others will see their conversions and be moved by those conversions as well, right? So, reduce their rates. Economics, very closely tied up with all kinds of other questions. Again, this is in the 6th century. The notion that the church starts thinking about economic issues in the late 19th century, right, which is typically the story we're told, right? Catholic social doctrine, concern for economic questions, arises in the late 19th century with Pope Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum. You probably all heard some version of that tale, that Pope Leo XIII promulgates that document in 1891. That's when the church begins to care about social questions. Well, all the way back in the 6th century, just as a for instance, you could do this many other times, right? All the way back in the 6th century, you see Pope Gregory writing about questions of justice, very detailed questions about the sale of grain, how much should be charged for grain. He actually suggests they fix the price. Right, let's keep the price, at one point, regardless of how much we produce. Right, completely involved as the Pope in all kinds of economic questions. There are many other examples of this. Another one that just popped to mind was Pope Gregory the 16th, in 1839, producing a document on slavery and the slave trade. Right, so this is of course before the Great Civil War in the United States. A pope in 1839 issues, I think it was a bull, or an apostolic exhortation, I don't think it's an encyclical, on condemning the slave trade. Right? You cannot reduce people from positions of freedom into slavery, right? This is, again, an economic or a social concern. This is something that has happened all throughout the history of the church. It's not new. It's not something that just, sort of crosses our mind in the late 19th century. Some of the problems, right, the root of all of these problems that these popes are going to fixate on, and also the theological tradition will fixate on, is ultimately problems of desire, right? They're concerns about desire, and there's something in particular about wealth that the theological tradition identifies as a problem. It's not like other kinds of desires, okay? So St. Augustine writing earlier than Pope Gregory, identifies avarice and wealth as a particular kind of problems. If you've ever read The City of God, or maybe you've heard about The City of God, I think it's in Book 5, Chapter 12, Augustine writes about the Romans, and he praises the Romans for their pursuit of glory and honor. Now, of course, he's going to ultimately criticize them for that, right? But initially, he praises them for that because glory and honor, even though it's not virtuous to pursue them from a Christian perspective, ultimately, it's still preferable to the pursuit of avarice. And what the Romans did, Augustine praises them for, right? What they did was they suppressed their desire for wealth, at least the early Romans, right? They suppressed their desire for wealth in the pursuit of honor, which he describes as being like sort of expressed on the lips of men after you've died, right? Being remembered by other people. This is a good by comparison to avarice, or it's more nearly a virtue, I think is the language that he quotes from Sallust. He quotes Sallust at one point, again, commending this idea that's closer to a virtue than avarice is. Avarice is a particular kind of disordered desire that these guys are all concerned about. The desire for wealth, Augustine believes, is a universal desire. But those who succumb to it are baser than those who succumb to the desires associated, or at least he thinks, desires associated with honor. I'm leaving, obviously, the desire for sex out of the picture right now, right? That would just muddle things. But that's, a particular concern of his. He identifies this particular kind of desire, this disorder that is associated with wealth, as being of a particularly strong type. That's, of course, should not surprise us when you think of the problems of wealth. It's mere possession, right, that we see in the Gospels, right? The Gospels themselves make the mere possession of wealth problematic. So in Luke 6:24, woe unto you that are rich, for you have already received your consolation, right? Just to have wealth is already morally suspect. Compare that, momentarily to today, right? Do we think of just the mere possession of wealth as morally suspect? In some corners we may, right? But for the theological tradition, it was already problematic to think about whether or not somebody could have wealth. So I wanted to turn and sort of look at an engagement with this. You guys should have copies of St. Thomas Aquinas, right? Maybe some of you have read St. Thomas Aquinas before. I know at least one person has. Maybe some of you have not. Has anybody ever read any of the Summa before? Wow, a lot of you guys have. That's impressive. Okay. So most of you know how to approach this text. Did you guys get Article 1 and 2, or what do you have there? Just Article 2? What is it? You're good. Good. You have Article 1 and 2. Okay, so this is Thomas writing in the context, as you can see from the top, of justice. Okay? So he's writing in the context of explaining what justice is. Okay? And he starts to talk about sins that are opposed to the virtue of justice, theft and robbery. Of course, in order to begin talking about theft or robbery, you have to ask yourself if it's even appropriate to talk about people owning things that can be stolen from them, right? Because if they can't own things, you can't have theft or robbery, correct? So there you go. Article 1, is it natural for man to possess external things, is a question he's asking. Okay, is it natural for man to possess external things? Do you have any sense of why this question would be where, what he begins with? Why external, do you think? Why the emphasis on external? Can you possess internal things? Is it morally unproblematic to possess internal things?
No.
It's not problematic, right? So, for instance, Augustine had already kind of discussed this in a way that Thomas would be familiar with. There's one thing that we all possess, and it's our goodwill, right, according to Augustine. We have the capacity to possess that goodwill. Only we can forfeit this. So the capacity to possess other things external to us, right, is a real question for Thomas Aquinas. And then, of course, the natural aspect of this question. You'll see it's compared to, the second question will be about whether it's of the law, right, or it's legal, it's permissible to do this, right? So the first question he asks is whether it's natural to possess external things. And again, those of you who are familiar with, reading through Thomas, you'll know, you begin with objections, right? So the first objection seems that it's not natural to possess external things. For no man should ascribe to himself that which is God's. The dominium, right? That's a kind of key phrase in all these texts. Dominion, or dominium in the Latin, and I think you've got the Latin right there on the left-hand side. Should be on the left-hand side. That term, dominium, which is a term that, of course, the medievals are going to use in terms of property, right? I have dominion over this thing. You think about what it connotes to us. Dominion, like a lord, right? That is appropriately suggestive, even in the English, what they mean by that. The capacity to direct those things according to my will. It's the same language that is used in slavery contexts, right? The dominion of one man over another man is the definition of slavery. And you'll see Even the Spanish scholastics will use this when they start thinking about the problems in the Americas, when they discover the Americas. Do these guys, right, these natives that we're running into, have dominion over their lands, over their property? Why don't they, if we think they don't have them? Can we have them? Can we have dominion over them? Or on what grounds could we have dominion over them? So this is a very, very important term, that term dominion. Okay, but the dominion over all creatures, according to this first objection, is proper to gods. And What's the source for this? Scripture, right? So the first authoritative source for the position that we might think, no, it's not natural for man to have dominion like this, is Scripture itself, is a psalm, right? The earth is the Lord's, etc. God owns all this stuff, and we can't have dominion over it because God has dominion over it. The second is Basil, right? So you get a theological objection. St. Basil, the words of the rich man, I will gather all things that are grown to me and my goods. And then the response is, tell me, which are thine? Where did you take them from and bring them into being? Did you bring these things into being? Of course, only God can bring things into being, right? Not human beings. Because you did not, you cannot have possession in this sense. Whatever man possesses naturally, he can fittingly call his own. Therefore, man does not naturally possess external things. Then the third objection, St. Ambrose, dominion denotes power. Dominion denotes power. No man has power over external things, since he can work no change in their nature. This is a kind of metaphysical claim, right? Only God has that kind of power. Only God can change things in their nature. Pre-genetic engineering and so on, right? Right? This is simply a metaphysical claim. You can't have that kind of thing. Only God, that kind of ownership. Only God has it. And then again, if you've read Thomas, you know, then comes the on the contrary, right? The sed contra. It is written, so another scripture, another psalm, thou hast subjected all things under man's feet. There is some sense in which we seem to have a capacity, perhaps, to have possession of things external to us. Thomas responds, okay? Now you look at his response. Classic Thomistic, you know, response. I'm going to distinguish things first, right? We can talk about this in two ways. First, as regards their nature, this is not subject to the power of man, but only to the power of God. Again, a kind of metaphysical claim, right? By their nature, we can't own these other things. Only God sustains them, right, in every moment. God sustains them. Only he has actual power over them. Secondly, as regards their use, okay, there's two ways to talk about this. One is in terms of power, right, the nature of these things. The second is in terms of use. According to this, in this way, man has a natural dominion over external things because by his reason and his will, he is able to use them for his own profit as they were made on his account. Okay? We are able to make use of these things for our profit by the application of our reason and will because they were made for us. And there's like all kinds of important implications, right, about that assertion with regard to our relationship to the rest of creation, right? We could talk about that. But the point he's just maintaining here is, in this second way, the way of use, we can be said to own these things. They were, in fact, given to us for our use. And then he provides Aristotle, right, the support from Aristotle, the philosopher, to give credence to this position. The possession of external things is natural to man. He then provides Scripture. Right, Genesis suggests this as well. All the rest of creation, right, we are created differently than the rest of creation. We are created in God's image, and because of this, right, we have a particular relationship to the rest of creation that allows us to make use of it. And then he replies to the objections again, as is sort of typical of the way Thomas proceeds. But what you see here, right? I'm going to ask you a question. What you see is a kind of qualification of the way in which we can be said to own things, right? We can have possession of external things, but that possession is qualified. It's possession with regard to use. Some of you may sort of echo certain kinds of things that you're familiar with from the medieval reflection on the way that we can own things, and we'll talk about that a little bit in a second with regard to the Franciscans, okay? All right? Let's look to the second article real quick, okay? Is it lawful for a man? Okay, first was it was natural to possess external things. Now is it lawful for us to possess a thing as its own? First, it would seem unlawful for a man to possess a thing as his own, for whatever is contrary to the natural law is unlawful.
Whatever is contrary to the natural law is unlawful. According to the natural law, all things are common property. Okay, according to the natural law, all things are common property, right? So if you just stopped here, you'd think, whoa, geez, I mean, right, Acts of the Apostles, this is how we're supposed to live. Possessions held in common, nothing owned by anybody. According to the natural law, all things are held in common. Therefore, we can't have, right? We're not permitted to have private ownership of things. The possession of property is contrary to this community of goods, he says, right? Therefore, it's unlawful. Objection 2, St. Basil again. The rich who deem as their property the common goods they have seized upon are like to those who by going beforehand to the play prevent others from coming and appropriate to themselves what is intended for common use. Now, it would be unlawful to prevent others from obtaining possession of common goods. Therefore, it's unlawful to appropriate to oneself what belongs to the community, right? So Basil gives us kind of, you know, the early bird does not get the worm kind of argument, right? You know, you're one of those guys who lines up for the donuts in front of everybody else and says, you know, they're all right. I'm going to get as many donuts as I can sort of pile on my plate, right? That's a problem. They're intended for everybody, right? You can't take all the donuts. Somebody back there is one of those guys. hit a little close to home, right? And then you get Ambrose again, and his words are quoted in the Decretals, which means basically, right, these are accepted by the church as normative. Let no man call his own that which is common property. And by common, he means external things, as is clear from the context. Therefore, it seems unlawful for a man to appropriate an external thing to himself. And then on the contrary, okay, St. Augustine gets trotted out at this point, right? So it's kind of fun to see the different sources that he uses, right? Scripture, Aristotle, Basil, Ambrose, now Augustine, right? These are powerful sources presenting arguments for and against these different positions. Augustine in this quotation is calling heretics, right? Naming as heretics people who believe you can't have possessions, right? That's what this says. They do not admit into their communion persons who are married or possess anything of their own. These apostolici, right? They do not allow people who possess things into their communion. They are they're heretics, these people. The reason why these people are heretics was because, severing themselves from the church, they think that those who enjoy the use of the above things, which they themselves lack, have no hope of salvation. Therefore, it is erroneous to maintain that it is unlawful for a man to possess property. Augustine seems, by naming these guys as heretics, to allow for the possession of property, right? According to Thomas, following Augustine, okay? Then he responds, his answer, two things are competent to man in respect of exterior things, right? So again, you get two things. One is the power to procure and dispense them. And in this regard, it is lawful for man to possess property. One is the power to procure and dispense things. Then he gives reasons why that procuring and dispensing of goods is necessary to human life, okay? So this is the first sort of way of understanding this. And it's really interesting, these three ways that he's going to give appear in Rerum Novarum. Leo XIII uses this argument to sort of support the naturalness of private property in Rerum Novarum, again, in, you know, some 500 or so years later. First, because every man is more careful to procure what is for himself alone than that which is common to many or to all. Since each one would shirk the labor and leave to another that which concerns the community, as happens when there is a great number of servants or guys living in a house, right? Like, you know, who's going to take care of the refrigerator? Who's going to fill it, right? Whose milk is that, right? Who's going to clean the toilet, you know, right? We know that there are these kinds of problems when people live in community. Notice there's no source here for this, right? It's almost experiential or, you know, based in reason, this argument. Maybe he was a member of fraternity, I don't know. Second, because human affairs are conducted in more orderly fashion if each man is charged with taking care of some particular thing himself. whereas there would be confusion if everyone had to look after one thing indeterminately. And thirdly, because a more peaceful state is ensured to man if each one is contented with his own. Hence, it is to be observed that quarrels arise more frequently when there is no division of the things possessed. The second thing that is competent to man, right? So that was the first thing with three different sort of explanations for things, right? Now, this is the second thing. The second thing that is competent to man with regard to external things is their use. In this respect, man ought to possess external things, not as his own, but as common, so that, to wit, he is ready to communicate them to others in their need. Okay? Not as our own, but as common. We can possess them with regard to our use, right? Not as our own, but as common. Okay, there's a ton, right, to think about. There's a ton to ask about. You know, but it's clear this is a qualification of the way we understand possession of property, or maybe the way we might typically understand the possession of property. So then he replies to the objections. I'm going back to the objections real quick, just to remind myself what those are, right? So the first objection, that it's contrary to the natural law. The community of goods, he says, right? This is a reply. It is ascribed to the natural law. Yes, the community of goods is ascribed to the natural law. Not that the natural law dictates that all things should be possessed in common and that nothing should be possessed as one's own, but because the division of possessions is not according to the natural law, but rather arose from human agreement, which belongs to positive law, as stated above. What is he saying there? This is a critical claim he's making. What do you think he's saying there? So yes, by the natural law, right, there is this conception of a community of goods. But what is he saying? Give it a shot. I asked my undergrads this today at CUA. What do you think he's saying here? Yeah, what do you want?
My guess would be that in order to maintain a community of goods, you need some sort of agreement within the community about how to distribute it.
I think that's part of it, for sure, right? There certainly is that moment of agreement about how we're going to sort of divide these things up. But okay, so here's the thing. According to the natural law, right, he agrees, the community of goods is ascribed. Okay, there's common possession. Right? But now we know, oh, I'm sorry, is that a hand or a pencil being held up? Yeah.
Just think that we only divide
That's pretty good. Right, right. And is this agreement contrary to the natural law? Does the natural law forbid our dividing it up in this way? He seems to think it does not, right? He seems to think it does not forbid it, but allows it for, in a sense, the reasons that he's given, this allows for more stability, more security, better care for these goods, and so on. And it actually harkens back to, these articles in this question come out of the second part of the second part of the Summa, right? You see at the top it says, 2-2, the secunda secundi, right? Question 66, articles 1 and 2. In question, I think it's 94, Article 5 of the prima secunda, right? The second part of the first part. I know, right? You guys thought those equations were kind of hard, right? This stuff is, in that question, 94.5, which he's already entertained, he asks, can the natural law be changed? Okay, he asks, can the natural law be changed? This is an important question, right? We think of the natural law as, for instance, forbidding the killing of innocent people, right? Can it be changed? And he says, well, look, in one sense it cannot, right? In one sense it cannot. If it forbids something like the killing of innocent people, right, it really can't be changed. But it can be added to. And this is what he's getting at here. Right? If you read the last line of this, hence the ownership of possessions is not contrary to the natural law, but an addition thereto devised by human reason. Human reason will add things to the natural law. And they become part of the natural law. The Latin, in a sense, if you look at the Latin, and you don't even have to read Latin to see that the Latin suggests this more strongly than this English translation does. These additions, in a sense, become part of the natural law. They're not contrary to it, but they're additions made for human good by the basis of human reason, much as you just suggested, right? So if you look at the Latin, it's, you know, sed iure naturali, right? They become part of the natural law, not forbidden, added to it for the sake of communal life or life in community. He gives three examples in question 94 of these kinds of additions, okay? One is the possession of property. Another one is the wearing of clothes, right? So, right, by nature, we're created without clothes, right? We don't wear clothes.
Yeah,
but
he wasn't writing this naked.
He was not writing this naked so far as I know, right? right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, the variations in which one could apply these, what seemingly, like, absolute or just kind of universal laws, like, you know, footwear. I don't think I'm going to share my sneakers with my friend because they might not be the same size as I am. But, like, at the same time, you know, like, it seems like we can make justifications for things like maybe property or food when it comes to, like, money, or what kind of property was kind of money at some point in time. So I'm wondering kind of how we've rationalized the allocation of these rules to the various non-natural things, things that are not, you know, my liver, my kidneys.
Yeah. Can I hold that off a little bit, if you don't mind? I mean, it's good stuff, but let's get back to that. I've got some other stuff to go through, and I think I still have time. Okay. All right, so put me on the hook in a few minutes. But I have to get out the third of those things real quick, too. So the first is wearing of clothes. Second is property. You know what the third is? Slavery. Not of the natural law, right? But, a reasonable addition given, you know, circumstances, you know, the application of human reason. Now, you think of all of them, they're clearly connected to what? Why don't we have common possession, nudity, and simply egalitarian societies, theologically? What?
Original
sin. Right? Sin. This is not the way the world was supposed to be. Right? We're not supposed to notice our nudity. Right? We're not supposed to need... We should be able to, you know, all clean the toilet. Right? Or share the donuts. And we should be able to treat each other as equals. But we're not. And these are reasonable additions given the fall. And... you know, I'm not here to justify slavery, right? I'm here to point out that from their perspective, for sure, right? Thomas's perspective, these things all trace back to, right, the consequence of the fall. It tells you then, right? I mean, as moderns, right? If we think of, well, gee, slavery's, you know, clearly a problem from a modern perspective. It might tell you, right, we ought to think about the challenges of property as well, right? Property itself. Right, somehow is connected by Thomas to slavery as a concession to human sinfulness. We can talk about, I'm not arguing for, you know, sort of the free body movement that, you know, the Freikörper thing that they have in Germany, but Freikörper Kultur, anybody familiar with that? FKK? So, getting diverted. It qualifies the conception of ownership. For sure. And you can see it here already. I think it's partly where your question is headed, right? We have to own things, ready to share them with others, even if perhaps our shoes don't fit. But I'm not dodging that question yet. I want to keep moving. So a contemporary of Thomas is St. Bonaventure, right? And he doesn't get enough attention
I think, often in our theological tradition. But he is approaching the property question from a different perspective. Bonaventure, of course, is a Franciscan, like our current pope's name, right? Taken by, you know, the inspiration of the little Poverello, right? The Francis who devoted himself to poverty. And that movement, right? The Franciscans, of course, are already tearing themselves up by the time of Bonaventure over ownership at all. Can there be any ownership? Right? And I think some of you guys are familiar with some of these questions that, you know, that they're sort of engaging. Some of the zealous brothers of the Franciscan community are arguing there can be no ownership whatsoever, right? Christ does not give us a model of ownership. Ownership, you know, private ownership of the sort that Thomas is engaging here is simply morally problematic. Others think that the order is embarrassing itself by its complete renunciation of poverty. It's becoming successful. Once you become successful, you have to sort of adjust, right? And these zealous brothers who are over here, you know, arguing for communal property, no ownership of anything, no ownership even by the communities themselves, right, are just embarrassing themselves and undermining the order. The challenge for Bonaventure is somehow to reconcile these, you know, these tensions within the order, and then also to argue, as he and everybody else wants to, that in some way, the mean, right, there's a mean, there's a virtue, all right, and the virtue is always the mean with regard to poverty, okay? So he deals with this in a couple of ways by making, of course, a distinction, is what these guys did. He argues there are different types of means in the handlings of goods, okay? There are different kinds of means. First, there are those who live in the world. That would be us, right? Those who live in the world, perhaps not Father Daniel. Augustine calls us who live in the world, and particularly men, weak, right? We're weak because we live in the world. We can't commit ourselves to things the way that Father Daniel or others who do, you know, make certain kinds of vows do commit themselves. So we're weak. Because we are weak, we can embrace a means of ownership that involves a moderate enjoyment of things and a pious dispensation. Dispensation, again, right? That term is very important to these guys. A pious dispensation of the goods that we acquire justly, okay? Very similar to what Thomas had just argued, right? Moderate enjoyment and the distribution of goods that we've acquired justly. They are not ours, again, in some unqualified sense. Everybody has some claim on them, and a part of our job when we have possession of them is to distribute them to others. These will be barons, merchants, even the church itself as an institution. Right, we'll do this in order to care for its flock, right? It will be concerned about moderate enjoyment of things. Evangelical poverty, right? Evangelical poverty, on the other hand, has its mean based on a total renunciation of possessions, right? There is a mean there, but it's based on a complete renunciation of possessions. This is the mean, he argues, Bonaventure argues, that Christ actually practiced. That's the mean of evangelical poverty. It's the mean that only a few people are called to. And those are people who have a certain kind of, you know, fortitude or strength that is not typical to the rest of us. Again, there's a lot to be said about that. But the notion of that kind of evangelical poverty, or like of a distinction between where one could locate the mean in things, shouldn't be that alien to us. If you think, for instance, about the difference between, like, again, the weak of us and the way we consume food, right? Most of us, the mean is going to be somewhere, you know, in the flabby range, right? Like, you know, I can sit down at night, watch a TV show, and have maybe one sleeve of Oreo cookies or something like that. But to have the second would be a violation of it. But if I was committing myself to a certain kind of athletic, right, regimen, if I
let's say, what are the good sports here? Probably crew, right? Like if I was, you know, if I rode crew or something like that, or I was a wrestler, right? The mean for my, right, my consumption of food there would be different than it is, you know, for the 50-year-old professor who's watching reruns of Stranger Things, right, and eating Oreos. Right, these are not, that conception shouldn't be that alien to us. And that's kind of what Bonaventure is working on, although that's really the principle of temperance there. That, okay, anyway, the simple problem of ownership is one that the church has focused on for a very, very long time, okay? Again, it's motivated by concerns in Scripture where just to be rich, just to be wealthy, already made one morally suspect. And conversely, to be poor, right, seemed to sort of guarantee pretty good things in the future, right? Just to be poor meant you were blessed, okay? And to be rich meant you were suspect. And you can see throughout the history, just these little glimpses that I've given us, real concern that the mere possession of property has to be understood very, very carefully, very sophisticatedly. It doesn't resolve things for us, but I hope it, you know, begins to give us, you know, some grist for our mill as we think about these things. I want to just like introduce a second kind of question that arises, and it's a more, it's one that's at least somewhat more contemporary. I think the other one's contemporary too, but this has a sort of real contemporary expression, and it's related. How do we value things, right? How do we value things? You saw, or I asserted, that these guys are really concerned with the way we value objects of desire, right? And in particular, objects of desire that are associated with wealth, with greed, with avarice, right? How do we value in our culture other kinds of things? And one of the concerns that has been raised for, you know, the contemporary Catholic social tradition is that the language of our economy, of our market, inclines us to think about everything in terms, in marketable terms. Right? So I just want to give you a list of some things, if I can find the list, that we can now buy or sell, right? Okay? I mean, of course, in the past, right, people could buy and sell people. And then arguably, you still can today, right? If you're involved in human trafficking of certain kinds, right? Prostitution, so on. You can still buy people. But of course, there are other kinds of things. Some of them, you know, kind of silly. Autographs, right? You can buy autographs from people. You can buy car, airport, amusement park, fast lanes, right? Like, you know, the quicker lanes. You can jump, you can jump a line in all these kinds of places. People just did it to me yesterday at the airport. Of course, being a sinful human being, I got angry and resentful. You can buy the opportunity to shoot endangered species, right? You can do that in the United States. You can buy people to stand in line for you at places, right? So if you don't want it, like if you don't even want to jump the line right at all, you can actually hire somebody to stand in line for you. You can buy national park prime campsites. This next one I know because I tried. You can buy papal mass tickets when the Pope came to the United States, right? And if you want to get, you know, plum seats, those are on, you know, the sellers of tickets, whatever, StubHub and things like that. You can, of course, buy pollution permits, carbon offsets, right? If you want to pollute, you can pay for it. You can buy, as well, friends, right? You can have, you know, buy like parcels of 1,500 or so people who will like your stuff when you post them online. My kids tell me these things. You can now buy or pay people to write wedding toasts. If you don't, you know, if you're a best man or something, and you don't feel like you have, you know, the gift of you know, composing that 35-second you know, joke and, you know, insight into somebody's life, you can actually pay people to do this. There are services where you can do that. We know you can buy these other things: blood, plasma, eggs, sperm, right? You can buy the constituents of human life. You can buy engineering of the constituents of human life. You could, in the past, and probably still can, buy these things called viaticals. Anybody ever heard of a viatical?
It's basically buying somebody's life insurance policy when you know they're going to die. So like if somebody was diagnosed with AIDS and they needed the money for their treatment, you could say, look, I'll buy your $75,000 life insurance policy for $40,000, right? You need the money right now. You know, I'll, you know, take the bet that I'll be around, you know, to see you croak and receive your stuff, right? And I'm sure you can come up with your own examples of other kinds of things we can buy. Is this a problem? You can buy, of course, you can buy organs, right? Human organs as well, right? But is this a problem? Are these problems? If they are problems, right? If we say, geez, that, wow, like, you know, you kind of recoil hearing maybe a couple of these things, right? You can buy somebody's life insurance policy, anticipating to make money on their death. Seems a little bit disgusting, right? Why? Why is it disgusting, right? One argument would be, a kind of libertarian free market argument would be, you know, if people want to sell it, let them sell it, right? And the market may even, right, bring in certain efficiencies as a consequence of that thing becoming commodifiable product. That's an argument made by Posner, right, with regard to human organ transplantation. Let people buy these things. And if you buy them, you'll create a market for them, right? And you won't have these long lists of people waiting for them any longer. The market will create efficiencies for these things. Right? So that would be kind of absolute free market type argument for them. On the other hand, right, probably some people in the room are thinking, well, geez, we don't want to be able to buy and sell at least some of these kinds of things. On what ground would you object? Right? What principle would you invoke in order to say certain of these kinds of things, even people, right, should not be sellable? Okay? That John Paul II in Centesimus Annus was concerned about this problem, and he referred to certain ways of thinking about principles that might help us understand what could be bought and sold. The principle of human dignity, right, arguably could help us here. Okay? But more importantly was a principle that I think ultimately has its roots in the first stuff that we started to talk about, and that's limited conception of what we can own. Right? If you already qualify your conception of what it means to own something, okay, then it's going to have sort of repercussions perhaps on the way you think of your capacity to sell it, right, or to trade it. He thought, right, the model of the economy that he articulates in Centesimus Annus, and then Pope Benedict picks up later, and now Pope Francis has picked up, is one that is juridically ordered, right? There's a law around the economy, and that law is given by natural law, right? The natural law will sort of confine the economy, you know, the movements of the market within itself. So certain kinds of things can't, you know, simply couldn't be violated, right? You couldn't simply trade people. You couldn't perhaps trade organs. You couldn't trade in things that were sort of fundamental to human life. Maybe things like resources like water and so on, right? You couldn't make absolute claims over, right? They'd be understood in ways that were more sort of comportable with that first intention of nature that these are commonly possessed, right? Or they're held in such ways that we, again, are ready to share them with other people. None of this sort of definitively says, you know, yes or no to these things. And that's part of what I wanted to show, is that these problems are complicated, right? The theological tradition I've been looking at has been looking at this stuff since the very beginning, right? Since the very beginning, and has been vexed by these kinds of issues. We expect, and maybe would only be satisfied with, certain sort of black and white responses to these questions. Often, again, you see certain kinds of critics of Pope Francis think there's a black and white answer to this, the extreme of which would be something like, market anything, sell anything, right? And Pope Francis is wrong to object to that, and the church ought to keep its nose out of economic questions, right? Another kind of response might say simply, you know, you can't really market much at all, right? You can't really market much at all because mere possession is a problem. It is problematic, but it's not a problem in itself, right? You saw Thomas, you see even Bonaventure, Franciscan, recognizing there's a certain kind of moderate enjoyment of things that we can anticipate. Again, most of us in this room need it, right? Most of us in this room need it. So, you know, part of what I try to do is sort of complicate things a little bit. I hope I've complicated them some. I want to get to your question, and I hope that there are some other questions, but this is probably a good place for me to stop speaking and just to listen again. Could you ask the question one more time?
Well, just thinking about these rules that are presented to us, and kind of apply it, think about it abstractly, and apply it to various things. And obviously, I think you answered quite a bit along the way. Thank you.
But okay, good.
Just like, you know, I mean, when you're, you know, let's say someone was born in a cold area, they need a jacket, right? If you're born in a hot area, you might not need as much as a jacket, but you need something.
Right, right.
So when can you own stuff and when can you not? Like,
right.
I don't know. I guess I forget the majority of my questions because if I don't have a question, I don't
know. Well, I mean, one thing that comes to mind real quickly, right, is one of Pope Francis's concerns is that there are people who have a lot and there are people who have a little, right, in the world. And so, I mean, those can be within a town, right, and they can also be from nation state to nation state or even from region to region, right? So from North America compared to South America, from Europe compared to Africa, right? There can be these kinds of divisions, right, in the having of things and in just, the mere possessing of things. Now, there's very little in what I just gave you, right, that would suggest disparities in wealth are simply problems. In fact, again, Bonaventure says a kind of moderate enjoyment of stuff is okay for people in certain areas of life. And even Pope Leo XIII, the Rerum Novarum, says it's not inappropriate for some people to live, you know, in certain kinds of ways and others to live in other kinds of ways, right? So the owner of the factory will drive a different kind of car probably than the worker in the factory, right? So there's not simply a kind of call for egalitarian distribution of wealth. On the other hand, right, both in Rerum Novarum and in some of what you just saw here, right, and of course what Pope Francis says and popes before Francis have said, those who possess things do have an obligation to share them, right? And again, we see this from Thomas Aquinas. You have to possess that thing ready to share, as though it's commonly held, ready to share it with somebody else who, because they don't have a jacket and they're cold, right, may need the jacket. But, you know, that can help inform the way we think about these things. It doesn't necessarily, doesn't always cash out so quickly in, okay, therefore, you know, this policy or that law or whatever. Father, yeah.
So I guess on some level, every time we try to move away from this a pure example of how things were in the fall, there's kind of always a tension between this world and the way things ought to be,
right?
Because economics happen in the context of the fall. That's an interesting thought, and so there seems to be sometimes people say, well, it'd be nice if the factory owner didn't drive a nice car and
that's right.
The money away, but
right.
Who would want to be a factory owner? Like, in the real world, right, nobody would want to sort of work that hard,
right.
Risk their own time, capital, whatever, in order to do that when they could get the same car
that's right.
By working for less, and so we have to create incentives or to allow for incentives. So you can sort of see why, well, fallen man wouldn't do this, but redeemed man or some sort of, in the future, at the end of time, when we're all perfect, that'll be the way things are.
Right.
Is that basically what's going on in all of our social teaching, is that we're trying to sort of say, well, let's see if we can get a little closer to Adam and Eve or the way they are at the end of time, or
that's a great question. And the way I understand it, I almost want to say, like Thomas, yes and no, right? I think any time, if everybody heard Father's question, right, are we trying with social teaching to get a little closer? I think anytime you sort of answer without qualification, yes, you maybe get yourself into a certain kind of danger, right? And the danger would be, you know, an assumption, almost like a presumption maybe even, that you know, right, and can unhubristically or unarrogantly describe the conditions, you know, of what that will look like, right? What an out-of-time experience of paradise will be like, you know? And we've seen communities that try to do that, right, historically, and they typically fail miserably. You know, become unlivable. So I would never say without qualification yes to that. Okay, so there's a kind of no-ish to that or something. On the other hand, for sure, right? We have a measure, right, of justice. We're given a measure of justice, and actually, I love Bonaventure, right? And for Bonaventure, the measure of justice is the cross. Right, I mean, it's kind of weird, it's, you know, right? But it's the cross, right? And that provides us with, he believes, a concrete standard by which to judge how we're doing. And certainly, as Christians, we're going to think something like that is right, you know. And so we could look at ourselves and our culture and say, to what extent are we exemplifying? Right. Well, there's no cross in this room, right? But right, you know, I'm not at Catholic University anymore, right? You know. To what extent are we exemplifying or living the life, right, that is, you know, that represents for us? So it's, there is a measure, and we're trying to live our, right, it's to me, it's like, it's always momentary, right? It's, you're trying momentarily to grasp it. And, you know, hopefully you live a series of moments, right, that where you're grasping it. But I just hate linear progressions, right, which, I mean, I think you and I might agree that sometimes you see some theologians arguing about, arguing for, and those become a little dangerous. But we do it. Look, we want people not to suffer as much, right? We want them, we want people to have who don't have, you know, and, I mean, and that's what we're told to do. I mean, does that get at it a little bit? Yeah, it's great. It's a great question. I had him first and then you, okay? Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess a bit more on the practical side.
Yeah, sure.
Could you speak about like the role of contracts, since that seems to be a huge thing, right? Like people enter into agreement to exchange goods or services, and sometimes like to profit from other people's exchange of goods and services, and, like, so it seems to be that with free will, like that there's a prima facie, like,
assumption about the validity of it.
Validity and so for bias in favor of the sort of libertarianish position.
That's right.
What are the limits?
Yeah. So that's a great, great question. So in Rerum Novarum, right, 1891, Pope Leo XIII, you know, he talks about this problem. What he says is, the justice of a contract is not guaranteed by consent alone, right? Okay? I mean, that probably makes sense to a lot of us. The mere fact that a person has said, yes, I'll do it for that amount of money, right, or that compensation in return, it's a free, right? It's free. We're not talking about like a Godfather scenario. I'll make you an offer you can't refuse, right? Or he puts a gun on the table. You know, either your signature or your brains will be on the table, kind of thing. It's not. But bracketing that out, right? Assuming right that free act, the person signs it. It still does not guarantee the justice of the contract because, according to Rerum Novarum and according to this tradition. You know, the labor has a certain value, right? And it has a value that is not reducible to what the owner might be able to extract as an agreement out of the laborer, right? So there's a kind of, objective was almost too strong, right? But there's a kind of quality to that labor that has to be respected. And then on top of it, the owner and the laborer should be in such a relationship to each other, according to this account, right? A relationship of mutual obligations toward each other, that the owner cares about the good of the laborer beyond simply the compensation he provides for him. So that care will even be expressed in that compensation. And Leo, writing again in the late 19th century, right, the tail end of the Industrial Revolution, says things like the owner has to compensate that person as, because he's writing about men, as a father and a husband, not simply as a work, right? Not some sort of like, you're just, Joe Capizzi, right? But you're Joe Capizzi father, Joe, of in my case, six kids, right? But husband as well, right? So you've got a family to take care of, and even in anticipation of, right, the family's future and so on. So all of that should be sort of factored in to that. But on the other hand, consent matters, right? The contract does matter too. It's not merely in terms of that consent, right? But the consent does matter as well. There's a lot of that's interesting there too that I could digress into, but we'll see. Does that get at it a little bit about the question?
Yeah.
So yeah, contracts matter, but there's a measure of justice external to simply the consent thing. Yeah.
I guess the other part of it, are there kinds of like areas of economics that just gestured to Wall Street.
Yeah.
About the increase of profit with not the increase of good or services.
Well, the an area that becomes particularly suspect, right, from the perspective of Catholic, even contemporary Catholic reflection, will be anything where there's not actual, things being produced, right, where there's just money growing. Right, or wealth growing, any vehicles that are not actually attaching to goods that are making human beings flourish, right, but are just about sort of money creating money and so on. Those are going to be
like a mortgage,
interest,
not necessarily like a mortgage, more like interest vehicles and things like that, right?
Derivatives.
Those derivatives, right? They're going to be morally morally suspect. Mortgage, right? Yeah, that's probably a little bit less suspect. What was that? Excuse me?
We're making a good amount of money on that.
For sure. Betting on certain kinds of, failures and so on, right, are going to be problems from this account. But, that's sort of, it's a great question. Is you following up?
Yeah. What about stocks? I mean, those are kind of pieces of paper that don't really mean anything, but you can gain value with them and everybody uses them.
Yeah, but they don't mean nothing, right? They do mean, right, you own some percentage of, very, very small percentage of, right?
Let's say, like, baseball cards.
And you get voting rights.
Collectibles, baseball cards. I mean, these are things which really have no value, but people use them for value.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about baseball cards. I've got a bunch of them. Clearly we misvalue, right, lots of things, right? I mean, step back from, is it right to own a baseball card, right, or a Mickey Mantle card or something, right? There are all kinds of ways we might say, geez, we have a culture that perversely values certain things. Like we forget about the baseball card itself, right? We perversely value sports in our culture, right? I mean, we just do. I'm somebody who loves sports. I played them all my life, and I still follow the Yankees, and so on, right? And the Knicks, which is harder to follow, right? But we clearly perversely value it, and you see all kinds of expressions of the way that we perversely value sports, right? The way colleges compensate sports coaches in comparison to the way they compensate, your faculty, and so on. Just as a very small for instance, right? This... all this stuff would sort of help us get there. Yeah, you very patiently waited, yes.
I was wondering, because we kind of, Father Dan mentioned a little bit, whether we need the ability for people to have incentives.
Right.
And something the question that arose for me is, do we need to draw a distinction when we're talking about kind of the Catholic response to wealth and having things to, the systems that we advocate for society and the ideals that we are advocating for personally, particularly in people who are Catholic, right? Because the thing that occurs to me is maybe we need for people to be able to get fancy cars when they invest in factories. Maybe that is a necessary
right.
thing. But ought we not advocate for a good Catholic person who owns a factory if your workers are, like, I don't know, busy, like, dying of diseases and you have a fancy car, like... You have problems, probably, that Jesus is going to talk to you about. So it seems like there's two things happening there, maybe? Where, like,
and the two things are, like, the one hand, the recognition of the fallenness of human beings, and then because of that fallenness, the fact that some people are going to drive really fancy cars, and the other thing being, well, as Catholics, can't we say, like, you know, wealthy Catholic business owner, you shouldn't drive a fancy car, or what?
Or there's some different ordering that seems to be necessary there. Does that make sense at all?
No, hey, look,
not that you
probably
want not to be able to drive a fancy car, but that given suffering of other people around you, you reorder your own priorities.
Right. Are you following up on this question? Is that
sort of?
Okay, just sort of, or yes? Because I don't want to. What?
Not like related, but not.
Okay, all right.
I think of what's that movie? Schindler's List, when at the end, like, that guy,
I only remember the Seinfeld episode at this point on that.
He says, like, you know, he looks at his gold ring that he had, and towards the end of his, like, shtick, you know, kind of
right.
people out, you look, you're not going to save X number of more people. And I think that, you know, when you do have a factory, and you do have a company, and you do have people who are in need, when you're going to go out, you know, replace your $30,000 tires on your Ferrari, you think, you know, I should probably help out that coworker who's really struggling.
Right.
So I think that you'd hope to think that some of those wealthy business owners keep their employees, you know, healthy and safe and happy before they, you know, enjoy the gifts that they've been given, wealth and whatever else it is.
Right, but they don't, right? I mean, look, I mean,
sure.
I don't mean they don't in a crass way, right, and they're all bad people. I mean, they don't in the sense that, and this is, I think, what Seinfeld episode is mocking, right, is that, I'm mocking Schindler's List or something. But what that episode is kind of pointing to is there's always going to be somebody who's sick, right? There's always going to be somebody who's in need. I'm not going to often know who that person is or maybe even encounter that person. So what is now my obligation, right? So I want to go out and buy the BMW, right? I worked hard. I'm fill in the blanks, right? I worked really hard. The company is really going gangbusters. And be quite honest, if I'm going to show up at a board meeting, right, where I'm expecting investors to help me, you know, grow this company, make more jobs and so on, right? And I show up at the board meeting in, you know, a beat-up Subaru, right? You know, people are going to be, it's just not fitting to the thing, right? It's, you know, the nice black BMW is fitting to the, nobody's with me on this. I get one. Okay, right, there's a kind of fittingness to the thing. But I could go there and I could say, well, geez, I'm sure this one of my workers, right, could really use the cash. I'm about to blow 125 or whatever it is that a nice BMW costs. I don't know. I have a Honda Odyssey. Six kids, right? The Honda Odyssey. Of course there's somebody that I could, that could make, in a sense, better use of that money, right? Or what would appear more morally, I hesitate to use this word, but I'm going to use it, scrupulous use of that money than I can right now. But no, right, you can't, can we live like that can we live like that? That's what the Seinfeld episode's kind of like, you know, I don't know, like, I don't know. I didn't look at any of this, right? But sometimes one of the things the tradition points to, too, is people who are poor obsessing about money as well, right? And this doesn't answer the question either, right? But it's just another thing to factor in, right? That sometimes those who don't have, right, or don't have as much can obsess and become resentful and so on. And that's not countenanced in this either, right? There could be, you know, different sides of a kind of disordered attachment to things, right? And maybe it's not necessarily an expression of a disordered attachment to wealth to drive the BMW, you know? Right? It could be, for sure. Somebody could argue it always is, but it may not always be. Okay, we could maybe discuss this more. Okay, the guy who I asked, the sort of guy, and then the guy in front of the sort of guy. Yeah.
So what I was thinking in relation to all this is, like, I feel like there's a balance there of, like, so the example that I thought in my head is, like, if you think of the factory owner, like, let's say that, sure, like, they have the, because, like, they should have the incentive that, like, because they're a factory owner, they can have, like, a nicer car or something like that, like, a few things like that. But at the same time, it seems like there has to be a balance there, because there's so often in society today of, you know, the factory owner who is making $5 billion when they probably only need to be making, you know, I don't know, $15 to $20 million as far as, like, the incentive.
The college basketball coach, right?
Example, like, that, like, sure, there should be an incentive there, but it seems like it should be careful not to be, like, I guess a clarification of, like, it shouldn't just be, like, whatever the factory owner decides should be right. Like, there should be some kind of balance and some limit there of, like, how much is too much.
And maybe this is the young woman's point, too, is that we want... It would be great if the limits were understood to come from us, right? Like, if we as good people could see, right, this is ostentatious, right? There's something morally offensive about this much wealth or whatever, right? But that may not happen, right? That's not always going to happen. It's clearly not going to always happen. The incentive is not just for the factory owner either. It's for the guy who's working in the factory who may want to eventually, right, who wants to work hard and save and, you know, and so on, right? So the incentives work all over the place as well. There was going to be another thing I was going to say, and I think I just lost it. Anyway, so, but when we say these kinds of things, we also have to think through what are the alternatives, right? And one of them will be, of course, that the state will determine those limits, right? The state will say, okay, you can make up to this amount of money, right? And that's not, like, I'm not saying that's necessarily inappropriate, right? But it has its own problems as well. And that's, like, in the background of all this stuff, and I thought this is where you were going initially, right? In the background of all this stuff, and you could see it, it surfaced a couple times, is slavery, right? Slavery was thought of, and you saw Thomas thinking of it, or I referred to Thomas thinking of it this way, as simply an essential feature of fallen society, right? He didn't make that point about slavery because he thought slavery was, you know, it's just a wonderful thing, right? It's a thing that's always been around, right? It's in the earliest scriptures. It's still with him, you know, in his day. There's some disagreement about that, but it's still more or less with him. We know it's, you know, up until the, you know, late 19th century, and arguably, right, you still have certain kinds of slavery today, although not typically by law, right? But for them, right, they were trying to figure out how do you live within a system that has, right, ownership by human beings, right, of other human beings. And I thought you were going to kind of say, like, in a sense, this is where we are, right, you know, to in the, right, the fallen state, right, with regard to possessions, right? Possessions are kind of like that too. This is not the way it was supposed to be. And now we're trying to figure out how to make the best, right, of a circumstance that is not the way it's supposed to be. And there's going to be all kinds of compromises and concessions made to human fallenness. And we're going to try to figure out, like, the best concessions, the best compromises. Yes, bearded fellow.
So, back to your example, though, about the company president who's going to meet some investors, it was like, it's disproportionate.
It's not fitting, yeah.
Okay, I mean, who cares? Like, shouldn't he trust God anyways and say, okay, I might forfeit some money, but I'm going to trust God and say that this is appropriate because I'm using my possessions for something greater?
He could say that, right? But, look, I mean... Look, you could, right? You could say that, for sure. But I think also you could recognize, like, have you ever gone on a job interview, right? Like, when you're, I don't mean, like, hey, I've gone on job interviews, you haven't, therefore I win, right? Like, when you are, like, let's say he's going to meet investors, right? And the point is, you want somebody to buy into your company. You want this thing to succeed. You want to grow it, right? You want to, right? you want to hire more people, grow this thing, you make the best burger, you know, or whatever it is, right, and you want more people to eat it, you don't say, well, I'm just going to let God handle this, right? I mean, you pray, right? You talk to Father Dan about it, right? You know, you get the blessings, you know, your prayer chain's going. But you also, I mean, at least you used to, right? You dress as well as you can, right? You know, you clean yourself up. You want to present yourself in a way that the guy's going to be confident in, right? The investors will be confident in, yes, we want to be a part of, you know, who you are. And I'm not saying the beat-up Subaru says they can't be confident in you, right? That's not the point. But the point is that you do what you can, right, to make that, to reassure them you're the kind of person who's going to grow this company, right? And I get, look, I kind of agree, right? Does the big BMW show that off? I don't know, right? But even, like, even Pope Leo, right, said there's this, right, there's ways of living appropriate to one's stations in life, right? And the station of, you know, Capizzi faculty member at CUA, right, is different from the station of, you know, either the guy who comes and does my plumbing, right, or the developer who owns my, the land on which my house sits, you know, right? Right there, there's not in this account a kind of egalitarian or leveling of this stuff. And we can disagree, right, about the details with regard to it, but that it's not leveling is critical. It's critical. Yeah, final question, perhaps?
I think maybe time for one more question.
Okay. How about two more, right? Okay.
No.
Everybody can look at him. No, okay, no more, two more. Can he go? You asked one, right? Can he go? Yeah.
So we see that the church has done at least wealth can be problematic, right? And then comes the reform, and the Protestant come with the idea that somehow the wealth can be rewarded from God.
Right.
And then Weber comes and says that allowed the capitalism to develop, right? So is that true that the Catholic faith is not as suitable for capitalism as the Protestant faith, or is it not quite this way?
Jeez, wow. Well, like you say, right, Weber makes that argument that yes, in fact, right, the virtues associated with Protestantism really conduce to the capitalist thing, right? And I mean, it's kind of, you sound like you're almost of Spanish descent, right? It's a kind of very typical, to some extent, Protestant perspective, especially Anglo-Protestant or Germanic Protestant perspective on things, right, that's critical and compares, right, the way North America and South America, right, develop over time. Look what you see in North America by comparison to what you see in South America, and by that analysis, the answer is clearly yes. The Protestants can do capitalism better than the Spanish, right, Catholic South Americans can. There have been arguments, right, that have said it's just poppycock, right? It's not true either that the virtues that Catholicism extols will be unsuccessful with regard to capitalism, nor is it the case that what you had in Spanish places are failed capital experiments, right? You had different values, right? You had different values that were extolled and pursued in comparison to other kinds of values. So, look, I mean, that's huge literature. Michael Novak, some of you guys will know Novak. He's a polarizing figure, right? But he wrote a book that really contests that Weber's claim and says, no, it's really the Catholic ethic. And there are some sociologists and economists who have argued that the earliest principles of free market economic approaches are not found post-Reformation. They're found much earlier in even Benedictine monasteries. I think Tawney makes that argument, among others. So there's a lot of literature that's you know, over the past, you know, century emerged that challenges that thesis. All right? Thank you.
With that, let's give Professor Capizzi a hand.
Thank you.